The Mincing Rascals podcast is sponsored by Ottawa, Illinois, the middle of everywhere. This fall, as the leaves are changing, get outdoors and enjoy some relaxation. Plan your trip today. Log on to visitottawail.com.
Wednesday, November 13th. It's 2:36 in the afternoon. This is the Mincing Rascals podcast. Regular host John Williams is at an event where the Chicago Tribune is giving the awards to the companies that are the best small, medium, and large in the city to work for. The Tribune never seems to win its own award. But anyway, I'm filling in. I'm Eric Zorn, former Tribune columnist. I'm currently publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, a little newspaper on the Substack platform that I'll send you for free if you email me, ericzorn@gmail.com.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute and co-founder of IronLight, a marketing agency working to change the world. You can check out my book, The New Chicago Way, Lessons from Other Big Cities.
I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter and columnist, now doing the Chicago history website, Roseland, Chicago, 1972.
And some of our other rascals are in undisclosed locations. Marge Halpern, I think, is in Hawaii this week. She's escaped the semi-cold weather of November in Chicago, and I think she's hiding out after the election returns were so disappointing for most of us anyway. Well, today we're going to talk about the Bears and their idea of moving to the Michael Reese Hospital site, and let's talk about what's going on with Mayor Brandon Johnson and his property tax hike that he's now pulling back, and his ongoing battles with Chicago Public Schools CEO Pedro Martinez. But let's start by looking at the election results, what it looks like a week later, what lessons we can pull from it. And I guess maybe we should start with this news that just came to us as we were getting ready to roll here, which is that Donald Trump has named Matt Gaetz, the Florida congressman who seems to be in all kinds of legal trouble. He's named him as, what was the cabinet position? I've forgotten already.
AG.
Attorney General. My God. It is, of all the strange choices and the strange and troubling choices that we've heard so far, this is by far the strangest and most troubling. Austin, thoughts?
I would agree. And this is Matt Gaetz, I put in sort of almost a category of his own in terms of anyone you talk to in Washington for a character reference on this guy does not have good things to say. And his public sort of persona matches what I think most people think that he does in private. The fact that he would be essentially, you know, the top law enforcement post in the country is truly beyond the pale. I would say by far his most controversial pick for any of the cabinet positions. There have been some controversial ones so far. That one definitely takes the cake for me.
Well, I mean, Matt Gaetz, yes, horrifying. I don't think he's the most worrying, because I am a little more worried about the Fox News host, whose name I still haven't entirely learned, who's going to be defense secretary. My understanding is that he did formerly serve. He served several rounds in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I think they also mentioned Cuba. You know, that does not obviously make somebody automatically the right person to be in charge of our military. And of all the things that I'm hearing people freak out about this week, and I don't know about you guys, but I'm hearing quite a lot of my friends and relatives truly having a hard time with this. And for the most part, I'm telling them to calm down. It's going to be 4 years. Let's get through this, et cetera, et cetera. But this actually, I think, is very serious. It's a very serious international situation right now. And he's picking people like Kristi Noem to be our homeland security person, and a Fox News host to be our defense secretary. As you guys know, I am very concerned about nuclear weapons, which no one else tends to think about too much these days. But according to the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, we are 90 seconds to midnight still, which means 90 seconds potentially to nuclear war. And a host of other nuclear weapons experts in a study last week pretty much backed up the idea that it's a very bad time right now.
Pete Hegseth is the name of the Fox News host.
Okay. Well, I mean, yeah, the nuclear experts are very worried about the Russia-Ukraine. They're worried about Russia with NATO, if there was any clash between Russia and NATO, they're looking at that as doubling or tripling the chances of nuclear weapons engagement in general, a catastrophe, which they consider 10 million dead. They're looking at like a 5% chance of that happening before 2045, but doubled or tripled in the case of scenarios like Russia and NATO, Russia invading Ukraine, or China invading Taiwan, which they believe there's a 25% chance of. So this is not really a time to have completely inexperienced people in charge of our military.
I think the best thing you can probably say about the picks related to foreign policy is that they're kind of schizophrenic. I mean, you have Marco Rubio, who a bunch of the libertarian people who supported Trump were freaking out about. There's basically like, you might as well appoint Dick Cheney or Liz Cheney or some hawk to Secretary of State. At the same time, you have this Fox News guy who seems pretty much an isolationist. It talks a lot about stupid wars, regime change wars, things of that nature. And then also right before this taping, he nominated Tulsi Gabbard for director of national intelligence, who also is like very isolationist, very anti-regime change war. There was a very long interview Trump did. It may have been the Rogan interview. It may have been another one right before the election. And he said something really interesting. I think it was Rogan, about the host brought up the fact that, you know, you had people like John Bolton in your administration. Like, why did you do that? And he's like, yeah, you know, John Bolton, you know, wasn't a fan of him essentially, but, you know, he freaked everybody out. Like he freaked out he freaked out North Korea and China because he goes in there and he's now, I think that's complete revisionist history on the part of Trump. I don't even think that that was a tactic that he meant to use. And I don't even know if it was effective in that way, but I'm sort of seeing that a similar kind of effect of some of these appointments where if you're an adversary of the United States, you see someone like Rubio and you're thinking, oh, extremely hawkish, but you know, other appointments are in sharp contrast to that.
You know, the thing about the whole crazy person strategy, which really goes back to Nixon, right? You know, let them think they think I'm crazy. So, you know, I can get what I want from the Russians and the Chinese. But the thing is, we may not have a great opinion of Nixon, but he wasn't crazy. These Trump people, I'm not so sure about sometimes.
Hey, do you want to take a break from the podcast to call these people you've been telling her things are going to be okay now that we know about Matt Gaetz and Tulsi Gabbard? You call them and retract that. These are a really alarming choice. I'm also alarmed by the presence of Elon Musk down at Mar-a-Lago. Seems to have Trump's ear. He's on these phone calls to foreign leaders with him. This is worse than I thought it was going to be. It seems like he is resisting the idea of pulling in adults into the room, people who are really experienced, who may not agree with him on everything, but who are going to help him run a good administration. And he's bringing in sycophants and toadies. Tulsi Gabbard is a nut. And Matt Gaetz is possibly a criminal. And he's going to be the attorney general. It feels like it is worse in this first week even than I thought it was going to be. I was sort of hoping that he would pull back a little bit. I think he is going to now make RFK. I thought the RFK Jr. as director of all these health institutions was a feint, that he was going to say that. And then afterwards, he was going to find another job for him. I don't think he is. I think he's going to put Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in charge of Health and Human Services. And we have all these looming disasters coming. Am I being too catastrophic here?
Is this, we haven't mentioned I mean, Stephen Miller, I think, is actually, just in terms of his policy positions, just a noxious appointment. He's going to be deputy chief of staff for policy. Obviously, the person in charge of everything, Trump's really right-hand person, is going to be Susie Wiles, who is the head of his campaign, first female chief of staff. Stephen Miller, I think, especially on the immigration issue, is just like very extremely ideologically anti-immigration, anti-immigrant, very nativist. And I think that will come out in a lot of the policies. I'm less concerned about the Elon Musk stuff, especially if it's him doing this Department of Government Efficiency kind of side quest with Vivek Ramaswamy, apparently, as his co-pilot on that, partially selfishly because Elon Musk did tease the idea of him partnering with Ron Paul on that. And Ron Paul's the only politician I've ever given money to in my entire life. And I would love for Ron Paul to be on a commission that says, here's all the wasteful things that the federal government does. I think that's like a good role for that kind of person. And Musk, like, despite all of his hypocrisy and crazy statements, it's very difficult to argue that he's not a very impressive person with a history of very large scale accomplishments at a degree that few other people in the last 100 years have done. And I was thinking about the last year of that guy's life is one of the craziest years of any human life I've ever contemplated. I think they got FDA approval on Neuralink. So he's like moving forward, like brain computer connection. Starlink went to scale. So Starlink is being used in Ukraine and middle of nowhere in Africa and to just people on road trips in the United States. And it's like kind of a miracle, to the humanoid autonomous robots, to the robo-taxis, to now apparently like assessing in some way basically the largest bureaucracy on the planet. So I'm actually hopeful for that one out of all of them, but plenty of dark spots for sure.
Managed to capture
and he caught a flying skyscraper with chopsticks. That's, I forgot about that. Yeah, that too.
He's got so much else going on. You forgot about that.
But if you were in charge of innovations or in charge of promoting electric vehicles, something where he seems to have some expertise, and I'm not discounting his ability as a business person. I'm not sure he's the scientist who did all the science on this stuff, but he clearly is a visionary and a wealthy enough man to fund some of these visions and get the right people working on it. I don't have any confidence in him necessarily in trimming fat out of the budget. And he says he's going to take $2 trillion out of, what is it, a $6 trillion budget or something like that? I can't remember but the percentage of the budget that he thinks he can cut is enormous. And you can't just do that and get rid of a few undersecretaries and people who are leaning on their shovels in the federal government. That you're really going to be cutting a lot of muscle out. And people are going to discover that they rely on the federal government maybe more than they think. Trump has now said he wants to get rid of the Department of Education, as though it's just a bunch of people sitting around with their thumbs in their butts talking about testing policy. It is a vast bureaucracy. And Austin, I'm sure you have some thoughts about the Department of Education, but it's not like it does nothing.
No. They're actually talking out of both sides of their mouth on the Department of Education, because at once, you know, there was a clip from several years ago that resurfaced of Trump saying, we're going to abolish the Department of Education. It's not a new thing. He just said it was an old clip. And I think what they found, because he said that when he was elected the first time, and there was research done about abolishing it or getting rid of the Department of Education. And it's almost impossible to even do that. But at the same time, he's saying we need to have, you know, these national standards to make sure that schools are actually teaching kids, right? Like part of the administration is saying we need to raise standards of learning and testing, which it comes from a national apparatus. The other part saying get rid of Department of Education. I'm totally open to eating crow in 6 months on the Elon Musk stuff. It could be a complete disaster. I'm totally open to that possibility. This conversation, though, reminds me, or some of the conversation around him being in charge of that, reminds me of the same stuff when he bought Twitter. And everybody was like, well, this is completely dead. Like, this is totally, and it's setting all these records for user minutes and ad revenue and stuff. And it's definitely not a profitable business by any means. Like, it's totally a loss leader for him. But it wasn't the catastrophe that everybody predicted while he cut costs by an insane amount. The one glimmer of hope I saw for him when he was discussing efficiencies in government were things like, someone said, Elon, like, you can't just fire a lot of people at these federal agencies. Like, there's civil service protections, there's all these other considerations. And he goes, well, you don't really need to fire people. Offer 3 to 5 years of severance. Offer, if we're printing all this money, offer a bunch of severance. A lot of people will end up taking it. And I was like, I don't think I've ever heard anyone in the federal government ever mention anything like that. That's something that comes from a person who's, you know, managed tens of thousands of people. And there's not that many people in the world who've done that. So I'm totally open to eating crow, but
this is exactly why Elon is both interesting and scary. He's the one person who is being put in charge of something who actually is real life, you know, successful and impressive. And yeah, he probably knows how to pare down a company. At the same time, it sounds like he does expect to take just such an enormous chunk out that it does sound like wants to truly cripple it. So that's a little scary, because he might be capable of doing it. On the plus side, maybe he actually does it in a decent way and doesn't completely cripple it. Maybe he stops short of that. And also, he's a funny guy, just like Trump. And I cannot help but wonder, how long can this little bromance of theirs last, because he's not a sycophant. You were saying, Eric, that you're worried about him, Trump, surrounding himself with sycophants and, you know, yes people, but Elon Musk is not really that, right? He knows what he thinks and what he wants, and to the extent that he may have papered over disagreements with Trump to get to the election, when it comes to what he wants now that the election is over, I don't see him being a yes person in real time. So that could actually be useful, but also I see it. I see the bromance as likely to blow up, and that will be spectacular when it happens.
And any of these aides who, if they betray him or lead him down some path that he doesn't want to go, ultimately is a disaster, are going to pay a heavy price for that. I notice also that Trump wants to reimpose prayer in public schools, which, of course, the Supreme Court outlawed back in, 1963 or something like that. But I can easily imagine the current Supreme Court saying, yeah, okay, it's constitutional. As long as you don't mention Jesus specifically, you're fine. I can imagine that happening, too. But you're going to need a Department of Education. You're going to need some centralized authority to do that. I just don't see him being able to pull off a lot of these things that he says he's going to pull off. A lot of things are going to be very expensive that we're talking about, especially the mass deportations, if he begins anything like what he's promised to do. But again, I do think that this is, certainly a signature promise of this campaign is mass deportations. There was an article in the Tribune, an op-ed in the Tribune this morning from a gay Hispanic man. Like, I'm gay Hispanic, and I have relatives who are undocumented, yet I voted for Trump because inflation and the border is out of control. And it's like, dude, you're gay. This administration is not going to be friendly to gay people, and you've got undocumented relatives living in the United States. And if Trump is true to his word, they're gone. And he seems to, it's just like this oblivion about what the true consequences are, which leads me to bring up this point, which is that there's been all sorts of soul searching. We did a little bit of analysis a week ago, but the election results were really fresh. And in the intervening time, I've certainly read a number of think pieces, which people are talking about, Democrats are doing their soul searching and saying, well, we were too far left. We were too far. We cozied up to the Cheneys, and that was the wrong idea. First of all, do you think the Democrats need to do that? Is the election was actually, a popular vote was close. It's 2 percentage points. Joe Biden won with 4.5 percentage points. The Tribune said that Trump had a mandate to act. They didn't say that about Biden. I looked it up. Biden won by 4.5 percentage points in the popular vote and a similar margin in the Electoral College. For some reason, everybody's got this idea that there's a mandate, this overwhelming repudiation of liberal ideas. I don't know that was the case. But maybe I'm wrong. What are you guys reading as we look through the last week and you're looking at, should the Democrats be course correcting? And if so, is it a minor course correction or a major course correction?
I think it's very important to know that all of these tectonic shifts in power are happening at pretty narrow margins either way. So all the things that people are Monday morning quarterbacking, they're moving like slivers of a percentage points of small demographic groups one way or another. So I think it's completely fair to say, on the whole, the Harris campaign was not able to motivate Hispanic voters, specifically Hispanic men, to come out at the rates that they did for Joe Biden and many other Democratic candidates. So I think that's completely fair to say. But to our discussion earlier about Trump's going to come in and he's going to do prayer in schools and make you say Merry Christmas at Starbucks and all these conservative culture war kind of things, I think that is a way overreach. It's a big overreach from the right in misinterpreting kind of what the mandate is to the extent that there is one. The Harris campaign was not able to give enough working class people the confidence that she was going to make their lives better on the axis of economic issues. And if Trump is not delivering on those sorts of things, he's going to lose a lot of that support. I think finally, on the Democratic side, this is now in a completely new territory in that there is not a presumptive standard bearer or next presidential nominee for the first time in many years. And that offers an opportunity, probably not on changing policy too much or even changing rhetoric too much. It's finding a candidate who is more inspiring or can speak with more authority toward economic concerns. And that's what I've been hearing more from the left over the last 2 weeks. It's sort of like we have an opportunity to find a new candidate that can win in a primary and actually engender a lot of popular support from the bottom up rather than from the top down.
I too actually would be optimistic looking 4 years in the future for many of the reasons that you already brought up. Thank you for pointing out, Eric, that by the numbers, it is no incredible landslide at all. I think people are just shocked to see Trump able to get both the popular vote by any percentage, plus the electoral vote. I think that kind of overimpressed people. And I think perhaps what also led to so much talk of a mandate is, and to be fair, it does seem to be accurate that he gained among such a diverse array of the population. So it wasn't just that all the white people voted for Trump, right? And they outnumbered everybody else. It wasn't anything like that. He did gain among pretty much all the major demographics, at least a little bit, right? And the Hispanic vote is being brought up, especially because he swung the most there. The NBC exit polls, latest that I'm seeing, is saying 55% of Latino men. Yes, 55%. So that's quite a bit. And if you look at the map of Chicago, such a Democratic stronghold, the 11th ward, which is Bridgeport and its surrounding neighborhoods, also had a big vote for Trump. So it was not just like the Southwest side, 19th ward. It wasn't just the Northwest side. It was also the 23rd ward, which is Hispanic, includes Little Village. And that was like something like 43% for Trump, something like that, pretty big number. And then the 11th ward, which includes like half our Chinese population, heavily Chinese, obviously not all Chinese, but heavily Chinese, had a pretty big Trump number in there too. So I think that is what is really driving this talk of a mandate. And I do think Democrats really need to take that seriously. But at the same time, it's not really a mandate. It is this tiny margin. And in my opinion, he's going to wear out his welcome just like he did last time. And if the Democrats are smart, I don't know if they're going to be yet from the talk we're hearing. I'm not sure yet if they're going to be smart about this. But if they are smart enough to pivot more to the center, I see no reason whatsoever why they should not be able to win it back in 4 years.
What about some of this talk about the transgender issue? A lot of people are saying that this ad that Trump ran in the swing states that ended with Kamala is for they, them, President Trump is for you, with images of trans women on the screen and exploiting this idea of giving gender confirmation or surgery and treatments to prisoners and allowing transgender girls to play on girls' teams. It's actually a minor issue and a minor problem. I think that the number of prisoners who've had gender reassignment surgery is like 2, I think. It's a very, very small issue. And that the problem, quote unquote, of transgender girls playing on girls' teams is really exaggerated. There are a few, but that it's a signal to voters, and was a signal to voters of sort of a more comprehensive attitude toward all this identity politics, which is off-putting to a lot of people people who are generally, you know, Democratic and liberal. They don't want to be scolded about pronouns, and they don't want to do land acknowledgments. They're not there, and they may never be there. But that the progressive, the left's focus on those, or even entertaining those sorts of issues, was a turnoff. And that the Democrats need to focus their rhetoric on some of these kitchen table issues and not there. Do you think there's anything to that, that maybe they need to sort of steer away from some of the more progressive ideas that are put out in the culture area and strike a more moderate tone?
That ad clearly was effective purely based on the fact that I think there was something like $120 million spent running that into the ground.
Yeah, yeah.
The numbers were like insane.
It was a giant percentage of their ad buy.
Yeah. Huge.
And they were doing that based on some sort of marketing information. They didn't just do that for the heck of it.
Totally. So one thing that Matt Iglesias or David Shore, some sort of Democratic commentator, was saying, which I thought was really interesting about the issue of taxpayer-funded gender surgeries for prisoners, was that that issue only came up because it was on a candidate questionnaire for the ACLU. Their point in this piece was essentially that even when you think of the role of the ACLU of protecting civil liberties, the fact that that was a question that essentially, you know, that did not help Democratic candidates really anywhere. And is that really a critical civil liberties or civil rights issue of our time to elevate to that level? Kind of spoke to, even at the institutional level, focusing a little bit too much maybe on these marginal issues, which, as you said, Eric, are just like a vanishingly small percentage of what just goes on in the world every day. And I think it is, in a way, a signaling mechanism that when a moderate voter who does not know any trans people and doesn't understand the importance of this issue because someone in their family or in their friend group isn't part of that community, that it just seems like, why would that be what you're talking about as my elected leader when we have so many other problems that are more relevant to my personal life? I think that totally played a factor.
Yeah, I think there's some lesson to be learned in the progress for gay rights in this country. You remember back in 2004, the Republicans put anti-gay marriage referenda on the ballot in certain swing states in order to drive out Republican voters because they thought that it would, and even moderate Democrats who, because people like Barack Obama back then were saying they were against gay marriage. And all that changed in a relatively short amount of time in terms of the arc of justice for civil rights. But it was not time. There was not a time back then for Democratic leaders to come out foursquare in favor of gay marriage. It just wasn't, the culture wasn't there yet. I think with trans issues, this is something where the public is not there yet. What people want to hear is they want to hear respect for trans people. They want to have rights afforded to them, but they also, you know, have some limits on it right now. And those limits may always be in place. I don't know. But it's one of those things where if you keep promoting candidates who are taking these maximalist positions, they're not going to get elected. And so the progress is going to be retarded in that way. And when you look also at the civil rights movement itself, the more effective civil rights leader was Martin Luther King Jr. and not the Black Panthers and Malcolm X. They were the ones who were pushing the envelope on the outside. And Martin Luther King was working sort of a much more of an inside game, despite the fact that I think his beliefs were in line with a lot of those radicals, but he knew how to play the political game. And these are essentially, these cultural issues do become political games. And not to, you know, use the word games lightly, but it's a matter of incremental progress and guarding your rhetoric on this so that you are welcoming people into your coalition and not pushing them away.
We don't know for sure yet. And I'm not seeing it having been asked in those exit polls, for instance, what percentage of people were swayed by the trans issues, especially transgender athletes. But we do know that the majority of Americans, and the number has grown in the last 2 years, majority are in favor of people competing in sports according to their biological sex. Gallup poll in 2021 put it at 62% of Americans in charge of Americans being in favor of people playing according to their birth sex, as it said these days mostly. And that was up to 69% by 2023. I don't see a 2024 number yet. So the majority of Americans are not in favor of trans athletes, trans girls and women in women's sports. And so by definition, it is going to be a losing issue if you push that issue. I don't feel that it's exactly the same as the civil rights movement in that when you're talking about trans women and girls in single sex spaces, locker rooms, rape crisis shelters, or when you're talking about them participating in women's sports, now you're not just talking about their civil rights. You're talking about how their rights impact and actually do conflict with women's rights. And so it is a different problem there. But that's necessarily going to change because people become more open-minded, because the conflict will remain.
I mean, and to voice this, you risk being lumped in with J.K. Rowling as a transphobe just by saying that you want to have, you think this is a conversation to be had. What kind of limits could you put on that? Because there are, it is a conflict of rights here, as Kate points out. And I don't know if it is resolvable. I don't know, you're right, whether public opinion is going to move on that, whether maybe they could come to some resolution where they say, well, if you've gone through puberty as a male, you can't compete in girl sports. We've all probably remember in elementary school when girls would run rings around the boys. I remember girls used to beat me in the 600-yard dash when I was in elementary school. And then, of course, you get a little older and the testosterone kicks in and the difference between the sexes becomes obvious. But
so speaking of exit poll, there was one from Blueprint, which was a public opinion firm, very pro-Harris, pro-Democratic control of Congress. They put out an exit poll that did something called max diff testing. This is not used a lot in politics, but it's really helpful when, for example, you're Apple and you have 20 new features you can build into your phone, and you ask people, well, which feature is most important to you? Like, people actually have a really hard time like ranking those things. So mm-hmm. There's a way to test where you can do what's called a max diff, and that gives you a utility score, like what's actually the most important. And what they found was that for swing voters who chose Trump, the third most important message was too many immigrants illegally crossed the border under the Biden-Harris administration. The second most important was inflation was too high under the Biden-Harris administration. And the first, this was higher than ever. There's like 20, probably 20 plus messages on here. Number one, Kamala Harris has focused more on cultural issues like transgender issues rather than helping the middle class. That was the first on this max diff testing. I mean, its relative importance to everything else was the top, which is fascinating.
It was done through exit polling?
It was exit polling from Blueprint.
It's not even true, though. Was it, Austin? I mean, I would not say that she campaigned on that at all.
No, but that explains why you spend $150 million on an ad to tell people that that's what the other side's talking about.
She didn't campaign on it. The problem was that she would not take back her extremely left positions that she articulated in 2019, that she was taped doing so in 2019 and 2020. She wouldn't take those back. And she had many opportunities, as we know, in many interviews, and she didn't. And so she left it out there that perhaps she is still in favor of undocumented federal prisoners getting transgender surgery. She leaves it out there that maybe she's still for that by refusing to have ever said that she had changed her mind.
And that's why you see some people calling for, like, what's the sister soldier moment on this? It's become like trite to even say that. But for this issue where you have someone clearly come out and say, hey, listen, if you are concerned about these kinds of things, it doesn't mean that you are transphobic and it doesn't mean that I'm going to attack you. It just means that some sort of showing of that sentiment. I don't know if that's a solution, but clearly that line of attack worked.
In the woulda, coulda, shoulda category, I think there's one mistake that Harris made that she couldn't pull back, which was when she was asked on The View how she'd be different from Joe Biden. She just stammered and said she couldn't think of any reason how she would. But I think otherwise she ran a pretty good campaign. She had about 107 days to go from being somewhat obscure vice president, such as it is, to being heading the ticket on election day. She generated a lot of enthusiasm. She came pretty close. The question about whether another candidate, maybe selected through the primary process, would have done better, just don't know. You can't say. I don't think so. But I think given the situation, if Biden had dropped out sooner, if they'd run a primary, they might have been able to figure out some of this messaging stuff and maybe come up with a candidate who wasn't going to be identified in that sense.
That was Eric Zorn, Austin Berg, and Kate Plies of the Mincing Rascals. We'll have more Mincing Rascals after this. Ottawa, Illinois is the middle of everywhere. Surrounded by open spaces, rivers, and trails, Ottawa is a natural setting that allows you to get outdoors and enjoy some fall relaxation. Settle down and snuggle up in one of Ottawa's nearly 400 rooms. Everything from established hotels to luxury resorts to private rentals and B&Bs. Plan your fall trip today at visitottawail.com. Brought to you by Ottawa, the middle of everywhere, and the Illinois Office of Tourism. And now back to the Mincing Rascals.
Let's move on to local issues. Mayor Brandon Johnson proposed a $300 million property tax hike. And just the other day, he said, basically, it sounded like he would. He said, well, I threw that out there in order to get people's attention. And I wanted to start this conversation with the alders because I am the most collaborative mayor in the history of the world. But basically, he was saying that it was a threat, like when your dad used to say, if you don't calm down, I'm going to turn this car around. Just wanted to get our attention. It seems like yet another blunder on Mayor Johnson's part, where he went out there and sent out this property tax increase. I have every reason to think that he was serious about it, and that was his solution to the budget problem. And now he's trying to convince us that it was just a feint, just a tactic to get us to pay attention to the budget problem. And now they're going to institute an extra tax on Netflix and garbage collection and what else? Austin, you follow this budget stuff pretty carefully. What do you think?
Yeah, this was another sort of CYA for a horribly blundered rollout of his budget. So, and we know this because a week ago when he announced the budget, the thing you're always supposed to do when you're the mayor and you're about to announce your budget to everybody is you tell all of your allies what the plan is and what you got to say to the press to say, we're all in this together. We're looking forward to it, like rah, rah. And Brandon Johnson goes up and says, we want to hike property taxes by $300 million. And then all the reporters go over to his number one person in Chicago City Council, number one Brandon Johnson supporter, Byron Cicho Lopez. And they say, Alderman Lopez, what do you think of the $300 million property tax hike? And he goes, I don't think I can do that. I can't support a property tax hike on the city of Chicago. Like, that is the basic bare bones work of intergovernmental affairs when you are the mayor. And he didn't do it. So what happens after that? Well, then like all the rats scurry off the ship. Like nobody wants, like you can't even get Byron to support your $300 million property tax hike. There's no way I'm going to be doing that. So that weekend, you had 29 aldermen issue a letter saying, we're going to hold a special meeting on Wednesday. Now it's going to be tomorrow. They will probably have this meeting saying, we're going to have a special meeting. And all we're going to do at the meeting is discuss one thing, Mayor Brandon Johnson's property tax hike. And if we get 25 people, there's going to be a quorum so we can have the meeting. And then if we have 34 people who will vote to suspend the rules, we can actually kill this whole thing right now. And we don't have to even discuss it in the budget session. Like, we're going to pass it right now that we're not going to approve the property tax hike. And that would be extremely embarrassing for Brandon Johnson for that to happen, which is why the day before that meeting was supposed to happen, Brandon Johnson goes out and says, guys, this is just me being a teacher, getting everybody's attention. Like, I'll back off the property tax hike. And it was all just after the fact constructed. So I don't know if you'll see aldermen try to embarrass the mayor in this way. I think maybe they think they've probably got their win because he said, I'm backing off. But I hope that they do vote on it tomorrow, and I hope they take it off the table completely.
I don't think anyone can be taking this too seriously, that he was just trying to get people's attention. If you watch the press conference, he was claiming this is the most, you know, open process ever for the budget. You've never seen these kind of robust conversations. If we had been having a drinking game for that press conference, I don't know if you guys watched it, but robust conversations, right? Everybody would have been under the table. So anyway, he's claiming you've never seen a broad, you reporters, you know, when's the last time you saw these kind of robust conversations? You never have, because there's never been this kind of open budget process before. That's why you've never seen this before. Well, no, the reason you've never seen this before is that any competent mayor first goes and talks to all, has their people talk to every single alderman to find out what they will accept and what they want in exchange for voting for the budget. So there's no surprises when the budget process starts in city council. There's no surprises. And frankly, that is obviously how it should be. He should be collaborating with them, and he's not. And thank you, Austin, for pointing out, if you don't collaborate with Alderman Cedro Lopez, who are you collaborating with? This is the guy that he shielded from being censored. I mean, it's the idea that he doesn't support it, but they supposedly had conversations about it. Right, no. Marianne Ahern, I'm pretty sure it was her, because you have to go by voices when you watch these press conferences, because, of course, the camera is on is on Mayor Johnson, but I'm pretty sure it was Marianne Ahern who said, she said, Mayor Johnson, why not read the room ahead of time? She said, you say you're collaborative, but if you had read the room of the council ahead of time, you wouldn't have offered the $300 million because they would have said no. And that was just so refreshing to hear. But of course, as we all know, he just continued with backing that new version of events.
We all know how healthy collaboration works. It's you say the craziest thing possible, and then everybody says, no, don't do that, don't do that. And then that's compromise and collaboration.
That's what Trump does, or says he's doing. I just said that. That's not, or his supporters will be like, he doesn't really mean that. He's just saying he'll deport everybody. He really means he's only going to deport criminals.
He's doing the weave. Mayor Johnson's doing the weave.
Yes.
Did he say we're the greatest freaking city in the world? Because he says that quite a lot. That would have been a nightmare.
You know what? I didn't hear him say that this time. Isn't that funny?
Really quickly, these taxes, they're proposing things like a Netflix tax, and they're going to increase the garbage collection tax and the shopping bag tax. And the papers have sort of added these up, trying to cut into the size of the property. I still think they're going to have a property tax. Like, they're going to have to close $300 million. They're talking, I mean, some of these proposals are, $10 million here, $10 million there. You're not going to get to $300 million that way. But a lot of these taxes are going to just, they're going to feel like nickel and diming. I know if I'm a Netflix subscriber, I'm thinking like, why does the city get a portion of my Netflix fee? What are they doing to facilitate my access to Netflix? At least with a road tax or a gas tax, they're fixing
garbage fee.
Any of these taxes, proposed taxes seem reasonable to y'all?
The garbage collection fee, I know a lot of people are dead set against that. And, the idea is that it's regressive, but all of these taxes are regressive. I don't know how Mayor Johnson thinks a property tax is not also regressive. Poor people are going to be hit just as hard by, if not more so, than their property taxes being raised. So I don't see how raising the garbage tax is worse than raising their property taxes. And as a matter of fact, I just looked it up since you asked about it, Eric, and I'm seeing if the fee was doubled, because right now it's just $9.50. If it was doubled, it would bring in another $68.5 million. That's quite a lot, considering that it's a $300 million property tax. So that right there is a nice big chunk. And the Civic Federation are like, please, Mayor Johnson, do a garbage tax. It's not like he doesn't have cover for raising that garbage fee.
That means that the mansions down near north are going to be paying this extra money, the same as the people in the bungalow belt. They're paying more. The same as people in poor neighborhoods are going to be paying more. So it's totally regressive.
Why can't that be adjusted? Why can't you adjust the garbage fee according to precinct or zip code, the way they figure out who's from a disadvantaged neighborhood to give them precedence in, say, a magnet school? Of course it can be done if they want to.
Austin, your organization is anti-tax generally. What do you guys think about this?
I think for the property tax, I don't see how one of the kind of discussions in this press conference yesterday with Mayor Johnson was pushing for a smaller property tax hike, which you had at least 29 aldermen willing to put their name on a letter saying I'm voting no against this. I think they would have had the 34 or 35 votes if Brandon Johnson hadn't backed off to just kill this thing entirely, including among the most progressive members of city council. You can't communicate to voters, oh no, I actually only voted for the $50 million property tax hike rather than the $300 million property tax hike. All their opponents are just going to say, you voted for the Johnson property tax hike, you're getting voted out. And I think that's going to be an extremely effective message in 2027 in all of these races. So I don't think he can get a property tax across the finish line. What I keep going back to is the fact that the 2019 budget for the city of Chicago was a little over $10 billion. The budget for the city of Chicago is now $16 billion. So our budget exploded by like more than 50% since 2019. And we were not like a third world, government in 2019. It was just 2019 level of city services. So I think there needs to be a much, much greater consideration for furloughs and layoffs, especially from central offices within the city. And Brandon Johnson won't touch it. He says it's a third rail because, those are the unions that got him elected, and he won't touch them. But that's the way that predominantly you should be balancing this budget, because of the extraordinary ballooning and spending we've seen from the city over the last 4 years, and the fact that federal money is drying up.
At least balance those out. Can you talk real quickly, either Austin or Kate, about this business of Pedro Martinez? They hauled him in, evidently, to City Hall this week, the CEO of the public schools, and read him the riot act about how he has failed to adequately deal with the closing of the Cerro Charter schools. And I think it looks like they're trying to work up a pretext to fire him for cause. This is another poop show that the mayor has managed to be the star of. Any thoughts on that situation?
We're going to get to the point where it's possible that Brandon Johnson will have gone through 3 to 5 different school board presidents before getting rid of this CEO he's been talking about getting rid of for months. You had John Anshi, who resigned. You had 9/11 conspiracy guy. He's out after a week. Going to probably appoint a new one in the interim between now and January. And then maybe you may even have another new one after January when people are seated. So I don't understand how any of the Martinez stuff has helped advance the interests of the students of Chicago public schools at all. It seems like it's kind of a sunk cost. Like Johnson's out and CTU's out on the record being like, we got to get this guy out. So they just keep trying and trying and trying and trying. And it's becoming harder and harder and harder for them to do. So I don't know if they're, maybe when the new board is seated in January, they'll be able to take a vote to get this guy out. But as you said, it's just been a stunning, like we were talking about, what priorities does this signal to people, like regarding the transgender issue? Like he's been talking about firing the CEO for months now, and there's no real clear path to doing it. And to put a fine point on the issue at hand here, which is the closing of these Acero charter schools, it's just so bizarre to see the same interest groups who are so anti-new charter. Like Acero, when that came out, all of these, CTU and Brandon Johnson, everybody's like, definitely don't have these. And then when they close, they're like, these people are the devil, right? Yeah. The reason would just be the height of
right. And yeah, it's just another instance of him turning on a dime here. And in this case, the Acero teachers are part of CTU, so that may explain why they're not as crazy about seeing them close.
Can I get a quick reading of the room here on the Bears' idea of using the Michael Reese Hospital site for their stadium? Kate, that's kind of in your neck of the woods down there in South. Is that a good idea?
Well, it's a much better idea than the lakefront that I'm so happy Governor Pritzker felt that was a non-starter. I'm totally with Friends of the Parks on that. There's absolutely no reason to be building a massive domed stadium right there on the lakefront. So the Michael Reese site, in comparison, is a terrific site. Now, the only reason, for people who aren't exactly sure where it is, it's between 31st and I forget how far towards downtown the entire site goes now, but several blocks anyway. And it's right along the Illinois Central train tracks, now Metra train tracks, and then Lakeshore Drive, and then a big truck staging area for McCormick Place, and then Lakeshore Drive, then the lake. And the original proposal, if they were going to put it there, from the developers of that Michael Reese site, was that they would build a big, kind of like they did over Millennium Park downtown, that they would plank over the Metra tracks and the McCormick Place truck staging area. And the stadium was going to be built on the southern portion there, or maybe the northern portion, but it would definitely go over the train tracks. And that was the Bears' excuse for why they couldn't be there, because supposedly the NFL would object to them being over the train tracks. And now they're saying that they've got a new plan that would put the stadium not over the train tracks, but on the southern portion of the property. And now, you know, lo and behold, now that Governor Pritzker and Springfield in general has not backed off and said, oh, maybe we could find some money for you. Now all of a sudden, they're willing to look at that site. And supposedly there could be more stomach for helping them out. Now, Governor Pritzker is not saying that, but the alderman loves it. The state senator loves it. Cam Buckner, who's the state representative for that area, also loves it. They all think that because it would be seen as being part of a neighborhood, Brownsville, and really helping to kickstart economic development, over there that it would be something they would at least consider. So my feeling is I still, although I favor them not putting it on the lakefront, and yes, I'm sure it would kickstart economic development. Number one, I still don't think we really should be putting public money into it. But number two, this is a gigantic development, like $3 billion development. And the neighborhood people have been in community meetings planning what was going to be in this mixed-use development for years. And I do find it a little off-putting that they just immediately are like, oh, well, yeah, and then there's that. We do have to go back to the community and be, as the alderman said, thoughtful about coming to them with proposals. But, you know, come on, it's a done deal. They don't really care if the community wants it or not. They're just going to do it. I do find that a bit off-putting. It would be nice to see a little bit more respect paid to all the people who live there, who have thoughts about it, who put time into this.
I think win-win-win. It's underused, highly valuable land. The Bears can do pretty much whatever they want with it because it's not in the lakefront. It is going in a campus, like that's basically the McCormick Place campus that already exists. If there's not taxpayer money that's put into a stadium for the billionaires' interests, which they can pay for themselves by selling equity in the team, I think that's a great site. Like, no state money for subsidies, no local for stadiums, no local money for stadiums.
That's Austin Berg. That's Kate Plies. I'm Eric Zorn sitting in for John Williams. We are the Mincing Rascals. We will be dropping another podcast on you a week from now. We're produced by Pete Zimmerman. And thank you for listening. Take care, everybody.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.